Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and this week we're going to bring you excerpts from our two favorite interviews from 2010, and we're going to start you off with my favorite work of nonfiction. It's a book by Julie Clam. It's called You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. And this book absolutely touched my heart. If you love dogs, be sure to listen to Julie Clam. The book is called You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. And I just love this book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tell us about Otto.
Oh, Otto was my very first dog as a grown-up of my own, And I had decided I was going to get a Boston Terrier. I loved Boston Terriers, decided I was going to get a Boston Terrier, and called a breeder in Pennsylvania who said, we're not going to have any puppies, but we have this rescue dog, and he's the sweetest thing. He's not show quality looks, but he's just a darling, and all he needs is a little love. And of course, you know, my heart broke in two, and I said, I'll take him. Where, you know, they were in some very far off part of Pennsylvania, and I went and got him, and he was the perfect dog. And and when I first got him, he was extremely low maintenance, very sweet, well behaved. It didn't take me very long to turn him into kind of a nightmare dog. I spoiled him rotten and refused to ever demand anything from him, including, you know, going the direction that I wanted to go in. You know, whatever he wanted to do was okay. So he got to be a little bit of a difficult dog, but he was the love of my life. He passed away when I was pregnant, but we have many, many tributes to Otto around our home.
And when you got together with Otto, you were a single woman, and you were, is it apropos to say that you felt kind of lost?
Yeah. I was definitely, it was a really rough time for me because I was 30. I wasn't seeing anybody. I had dated a lot, but just didn't feel connected to anybody, and kind of felt like worse when I would date people. I was working as a clerk in my dad's insurance company, and it was supposed to be temporary, and it was like 6 years later, I was still doing it and writing little things for magazines, but nothing that would have been able to pay my rent. And, you know, I just didn't know what was going to ever make me sort of grow up. I mean, I wasn't thinking in those terms, like, I want to grow up. But I sort of thought, like, when the heck is my life going to start? And in many ways, it started when I got Otto. I mean, he really introduced me to the concept of, you know, unconditional love and mutual responsibility. So it changed everything. And, it sort of made me see that if you love someone, you are willing to compromise, which I never kind of saw with the men that I was with because I didn't love them the way that I loved Otto. But then I thought, you know, there's a possibility. It's possible that there's a man out there with a similar, who I could feel similarly towards, certainly not love as much as I loved Otto, but you know, maybe he got a close second or third.
This was all very mystical, wasn't it? Because you dreamed about him.
I did. It was so amazing. I had a dream about a Boston Terrier, and I was on the phone the next day with my best friend who worked at Bloomingdale's at the time, in their marketing department. And I said, I think it's a Boston Terrier. I'm not positive. Oh, no, I knew it was a Boston Terrier. I said, I dreamt about a Boston Terrier, and I think I want to get one. And she said, oh, that's funny. There's a guy in my office who has one. And she just sort of said, like, hold on a second, Michael, what kind of dog do you have? And he said, Boston Terrier. And she said, let me get the information of the breeder. And that was the breeder who had Otto. So it was all, you know, very serendipitous. And
it was meant to be.
It was meant to be. He was so meant to be my dog.
Julie Klamm joins us. Her book is You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. And I've got to say, I know this is an Otto on the cover, but this is the sweetest cover.
It is. When they were coming up with covers, they had sent a few different covers with different pictures of dogs, and that dog has the essence of Otto, this sort of the same look in the eye and sort of sweet sadness, and you know, it reminded me of Otto. There was no question about which picture we were going with. To me, the other dogs just looked like dogs.
He's kind of funny looking, though, isn't he?
He is funny looking, and I think Boston Terriers are sort of, I've heard them described as, you know, faces only mothers could love type of dogs. But, they have, you know, pushed in faces and sort of bulgy eyes, and they're kind of have a comical look about them. But I feel like everybody has the kind of dog that they're sort of attracted to, and that's the dog I'm attracted to, the pushed in face and the bug out eyes.
Julie, your first memoir, Please Excuse My Daughter, came out a couple years ago, and I really liked that book a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Reading this new one, I thought, wow, I love that first book, but the second book, they're very different. And the first one is, there's almost a neurotic element, which is funny. I love that, right? Mm-hmm. But this new one, you're really grounded. And I'm wondering, I'm reluctant to ask this, but how are you able to speak with such an authentic voice, to speak from your heart so truly? I mean, it really feels like that's what you're doing.
When I write, you mean?
Yeah.
I feel like I write the way I speak. I very, very, it took me a long time to be able to do that, but I pretty much write in my voice. And it's lucky that that works, because I don't know how else I would be able to do it. Maybe 8 years ago, I wrote an essay for Glamour magazine, and it was the first time I'd written an essay, and I just wrote it the way I would tell the story, and it was sort of a turning point, because before that I had done a lot of celebrity interviews and stories about like women who lie and whatever, why men want to have sex and all sorts of things that were assigned to me. And then this sort of switched over to where it was my story and I was telling it, and telling it the way I would tell a story. And I got very positive feedback from the editors there. And I did a story after that, which I didn't do that with. And they said, we want that other voice. And so I thought, all right, that's good, because, you know, that's the one I have. So, so it's sort of that way. And I think that, you know, the difference between the first book and the second book is that the first book was all about, you know, me and my sort of, I hate the word journey because it sounds so self-important, but, how I got to wherever I got to. That's the way I like to put it, not journey. Mm-hmm. The second book is much more about outward things. It's the dogs and the people that I met, and it's not so much about my Michigas. You know, I feel like it was much more, I was much more comfortable. It was my second book, so I had the experience of writing the first book, and hopefully grew somewhat from it. But I also felt like this time, you know, I am very, very passionate about this subject, and but it was easier for me to talk about my dog love.
And Otto really opened up a lot of doors for you, and you dreamed him, he came to you, he He showed you so much. You describe him as your great relationship, your great love of your life. And he opened the door to all these other dogs.
Right. That's right. Well, when he died, I was 4 months pregnant, and I can't even put into words how devastated I was from his death. It was the worst thing I had gone through in my life, you know, up to that point. And I felt like life had ended. And at the same time, I was pregnant and I was, you know, hormonal and crazy and focusing on, you know, this, my new baby and coming. And I talked to an animal psychic who said that, and, you know, I tend to sort of try everything and, you know, take whatever sounds right. But she said that Otto died because I was going to need somebody on the other side when this birth happened, that I was going to have trouble. And at that point, I was, you know, incredibly healthy and fine, and it didn't really sort of ring true with me. And I ended up getting very sick. I had preeclampsia and, you know, had an emergency C-section, and I had a really, really rough birth. And, you know, we were both okay, and so, you know, both my husband and I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe Otto was on the other side there pulling my daughter through. And once, you know, things sort of settled down, I always thought of how I could honor him. And, you know, I wanted to work with other, you know, help other dogs like Otto, dogs that people, you know, either abandoned or got rid of or, you know, had to give up, you know, or whatever reason. And so I found this rescue group, Northeast Boston Terrier Rescue, and started working with them. And it was just this amazingly fulfilling, wonderful experience, even when it was horrible. You know, there were a lot of lessons to be learned. And there were, you know, some rough moments, but it was, and I just felt like every dog I came in contact with, that I helped to get to the next place, to their forever home, you know, that was a tribute to Otto. So,
and as you say in the book, someone, a wise dog woman, told you that dogs, you don't own them. They look for you. Mm-hmm. They look for the person that they want to be with.
Right. I totally feel that way because, you know, the dogs that we've ended up keeping have all been dogs that came to us through a strange way, you know, we found or whatever, and it's not necessarily what you imagine in your head, but that I do think that, I mean, I feel like dogs are so much more spiritually aware or sort of like they operate on another level. You know, that's what I always feel like, that dogs live shorter lives than us because they're sort of higher, they have a higher evolution, higher level of highly evolved. I don't know.
They're more evolved.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And their, you know, communications are nonverbal and, but very clear. You know, there have been so many times where I've been walking and I've found a dog who'd been abandoned, and it's just this weird, random thing. And I have to think that there's, like, you know, a dog underground railroad where they say, like, hey, you know, Lucky, if you're lost, go stand by 145th and West, you know, and Broadway, because Julie Clam's going to be walking by there on her way home from the gym, and she'll get you somewhere, you know.
Here she comes.
Yeah, here she comes. Look cute.
And that was Julie Clam. We did an interview for her book, You Had Me at Wolf, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness, And that was my favorite work of nonfiction from last year. Up next, an excerpt from my favorite fiction interview with Gary Steingart. His novel is called Super Sad True Love Story. Your new book, Gary, is called Super Sad True Love Story. And it's a book that's set a little bit in the future, I think, but reading it, I thought to myself, you know, this is very Jules Verne kind of territory, because we read it and we go, oh, yeah, right, that'll never happen. But sadly, the sad part is it all seemed like it could.
I think it could. I think it is happening in many ways. You know, when I started writing this book in 2006, I kind of had a feeling that things would go badly for our country. And I grew up in the Soviet Union, so I kind of know it when a big empire begins to teeter on the edge. And so I thought, okay, what if something crazy happened, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns collapsed? And then I took a ride in a Chevy, and I thought, you know, this is a really bad car. I mean, what happened if GM and Ford would collapse and Chrysler? And as I started writing this book, all these things started happening. So I started having to race ahead of reality. So by the end of the book, you know, the whole country collapses and is bought out by a Norwegian hedge fund. So, you know, it was, it's tough to write even speculative fiction these days, because we don't really live in a world where there's any kind of present. Everything is set to the future. Mm. So you really have to race ahead.
The book consists of diary entries and also cyber traffic in a way. I guess you would call it that. That's probably an arcane term at this point, but the diary entries are by a guy named Lenny Abramov, and he's a little bit like you, isn't he? Just a little bit?
I think all my characters have been a little bit like me, maybe the exception of the Misha Weinberg, the hero of Absurdistan, who is 325 pounds, and although I do like to feast on many animals, I'm still not up to that kind of girth yet.
And Lenny is on the cusp of 40, and as the book opens, he's in Europe, and he falls hopelessly in love with a woman.
That's right. Her name is Eunice Park. She is 15 years younger than him, the daughter of Korean immigrants. The problem with their relationship is that 15 years may not seem like a terribly long distance difference in age, but in the world in which Lenny and Eunice live, Lenny still belongs to the old world, the world where books actually exist, where people still ruminate about things. And Eunice, in this future, she may be one of the smarter people around of her generation, but this is a generation that is mostly interested in going into this thing called global teens and ass luxury and shopping. So Lenny thinks she's very smart. He calls her my reluctant sentence monger because she's able to put together a sentence with a subject and a predicate, which in the futuristic world they live in is highly unusual.
I think the feature that struck me as the most eerie, and also another possible reality, was these poles that are along the street.
Yes, the poles measure one's credit rating and broadcast that credit rating onto the street, so anybody, as soon as you pass by, everybody knows what your credit rating is. I recently applied for a mortgage, so it was interesting for me to constantly have my own credit rating reviewed. And of course, a few years ago, mortgages were just there for the asking. You could take whatever you wanted, but these days, obviously, after the financial debacle, there's a great deal of scrutiny. You know, applying for a mortgage was like applying to Harvard or something. You had to jump through a lot of hoops. So I kind of felt like the world I was describing was already coming true.
And this is a world where the so-called low net worth individuals are treated with scorn and derision.
This feels very much like living in New York City, a universe where people with low net worth are treated with scorn and derision. And in fact, it feels often like Manhattan has become just an island of millionaires. I was at some bar and somebody introduced themselves as a VC, and I said, oh, you're a Viet Cong? And they said, no, I'm a venture capitalist. I was quite surprised by that. And in the book, in fact, most of the what's left of the New York intelligentsia is forced to move out to Staten Island, which is now the hipster neighborhood, the only one that people can still afford who aren't part of this financial elite.
Gary Steingart joins us. His new book is Super Sad, True Love Story. You employ a lot of acronyms, and many of them are not definable on public radio.
Yes. It's true. I know. Even when I do readings and there's any kids in the room, I have to tone it down a little bit because a lot of these acronyms are quite raunchy, to say the least. The one that I sort of used recently is Timatov, which sounds like a Hebrew word almost, T-I-M-A-T-O-V, which young people, when they see Lenny, they say, ah, Timatov, which means, think I'm about to openly vomit. So I've been practicing saying that one.
Speaking of Judaism, I kept trying to think of the right Yiddish word for Lenny. What would it be, do you think?
Well, you know, some people say, oh, maybe he's a schmuck or a schlemiel. I don't think so. That's a little too, you know, that's not exactly right. I think he's more of a nebbish, which is somebody who's been a little bit too hurt by life and is unable to fully put himself out there and be a, I guess the word that's used in college campuses is agency. He doesn't have very much agency. He's a shy man. He's very much hurt by his background and his past, and he's unable to fully assert himself with anything, with his boss, with the society at large, and most of all, he's unable to assert himself with Eunice, whom he loves very, very, very much, but with whom he's unable to quite complete the deal for most of the book.
But he is a mensch.
He's a mensch. He's definitely a mensch, which is quite a compliment. He's definitely a mensch, but, you know, he's a mensch nebbish, which is a great combination, because I hope that that's the kind of person that one both feels sorry for and learns to love at the same time.
I love the device that you employ of having Lenny's diary entries, and then we get to read Eunice's email contacts and text messages with family members and a good friend of hers, and see what she's thinking of Lenny at the same time that he's fantasizing about her.
Yes.
And Eunice, she's a consumer, but there's something very sweet about her.
I think so. This is one of the first books I've written, perhaps the first book I've written, where the more I wrote it, the more I began to feel something for these characters. I subject my characters to so many awful things. I mean, God knows what I did to poor Misha in Absurdistan. But in this book, I became very tender toward my characters, especially toward Eunice. And I almost thought, my God, you know, they really do deserve each other. They both have these dysfunctional immigrant families, his Russian, her Korean. I almost wish things worked out better for them. But it's not their fault. You know, it's the society that grinds them to a pulp. And this reminded me very much of, or at least maybe this was an inspiration, was, of course, Orwell's 1984, which is a book I recall quite well, not just for its totalitarian aspects, but for the fact that Julia and Winston really are in love, and they do hang, you know, they hold on to each other despite everything that the society throws at them. In the end, of course, that they can't do so, but they try. They love each other, truly.
The 1984 Orwell symbolism combined with the siren in the background is a wonderful coincidence.
My building is actually on fire as we're doing this interview. I think it'll be okay, but there's a fire going on.
That's Gary Steingart talking about his novel, Super Sad, True Love Story. That's my favorite fiction interview from the Best of the Book Nook on 2010's Book Nook list. And one thing I really like about Gary is Gary's kind of old-fashioned. He's the kind of guy that I think would rather read a good book than watch television. We're going to bring you one more short excerpt from our interview with Gary Steingart, as he talks about Super Sad, True Love Story. This is a world where your nebbish Lenny has this collection of moldering books that he treasures. And I connected with him on that level so deeply when we read the newspapers and we see that everyone's going to electronic books or they're not reading books at all.
Right.
It really jives with your whole plot with these people all walking around with their devices that plug them into this cyber world. And at the point where suddenly they all lose that, it's a world where people are devastated. And each of us thinks what it would be like to lose our high-speed connection and how frustrated and upset we would be. And it's all there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, one of the impetuses for that idea was I have a cable repairman come to my house. And I, like Lenny, I have this incredibly large wall of books where I have, thousands of books in my apartment. And I happen to have a 25-inch television screen, which is considered very small. And this television repairman was shocked, and he said, "Oh my God, why you got all them books in your house and such a small TV?" He was just very upset. And then he said, "Well, at least you got them all neat. They're not just lying around, they're on the shelves, Like it would be this terrifying calamity if there were books lying around. Maybe you would trip over them on the way to the television set or something.
I'm not a person who frequents bars very often, and I think one reason for that is because I can remember in my youth going into these places, and you'd get that feeling of, well, he's the third least sexy person in the room. And you have translated this into the modern age, this whole sense of rating people in this kind of a situation.
Well, I think we're being rated almost by the second. There's my credit rating. Amazon is now ranking my book. We're always being ranked or rated somehow. And in this future, there's this device called the apparat. And as soon as my nebbish Lenny walks into, let's say, a bar, everyone else rates him. So he immediately knows if he's, let's say, the 18th ugliest person in the bar. And also maybe he's the 7th richest person in the bar. And all these different things. I can't even say some of these ratings on family radio, but they're pretty, pretty obscene, because every little bit of him is being rated as soon as he walks into any kind of public space. And that's one thing Lenny likes about Eunice, is that whenever he stands next to her, his ratings go up because she's so beautiful.
There you have it. My favorite Book Nook interviews from 2010. We heard from Julie Clam talking about her touching memoir called You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. And we also heard from Gary Steingart. His novel, Super Sad True Love Story, is a hilarious but slightly frightening look at the very near future. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Tune in to the program next week when my guest will be Steve Palumbi. He's the co-author of a very encouraging environmental story. It's called The Death and Life of Monterey Bay, a story of revival. 80 years ago, Monterey Bay was a mess. Canneries were spewing out pollution. The environment was in chaos. It's much nicer now. We'll hear about it next week right here in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.